The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in Intellectual History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie. Today I'll be speaking with Christopher Dietrich, an assistant professor of history at Fordham University. We will be talking about his new book, Oil Revolution, Anti-Colonial Elites, Sovereign Rights, and the Economic Culture of Decolonization. It was published last year by Cambridge University Press. Oil Revolution is an impressive feat of scholarship. In the book, Dietrich recounts a critical moment in global history, that of the early 1970s energy crisis, or OPEC crisis, except he doesn't tell this story in terms familiar to most Americans. Rather, he provides a much less Western and much needed texture to the energy crisis by foregrounding oil elites from the Middle East and Latin America. He explores how these global South elites overcame political and ideological differences and tried to transform a global economy that privileged Europe and the United States. The book should interest a broad audience, including scholars of U.S. foreign relations, the global South, resource politics, global governance, and intellectual history. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'm speaking with Chris Dietrich about his really smart new book called Oil Revolution, Anti-Colonial Elites, Sovereign Rights, and the Economic Culture of Decolonization. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Your book was an immense pleasure to read, and I learned so much from it. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And so what drew you to becoming a historian?
Well, I was always interested in history. I was a history major and an English major in college. And I was living in Mexico about a decade ago, maybe longer. And I was sort of thinking about what the next step was. And a good friend of mine was in grad school for history, and he sent me his master's thesis, and I really liked it. And I thought it was really interesting, and it looked like a lot of fun. So I took some time and applied to different history programs, and was fortunate enough that the University of Texas accepted me.
Wonderful. And so your book is a really fascinating take on a story that I think most people will have some familiarity with. However, it tells that story from a perspective that will be less familiar to many listeners based in North America. And that's the perspective of the Global South. And you know, that's even evident in your title, Oil Revolution, rather than Oil Crisis. Oil Revolution being a term used much more in the Global South than in the Global North. And so what brought you to this topic in particular?
Right. So the energy crisis, or the oil, or the oil shock, as we tend to call it, or the oil revolution, is a fascinating moment in the 1970s in international history and in diplomatic history. It's the largest transfer of wealth, the largest peaceful transfer of wealth, I believe, in human history. It's also the largest infusion of liquid capital in the history of modern capitalism.
Wow!
So that was it's a really important and interesting event. And I started studying it. I was initially interested in the 1982 debt crisis, but the sort of the scholarly literature wasn't as well developed on that, and the archives in the United States weren't readily available. They're still going through declassification now. So I moved back and thought about the causes of that debt crisis, and a lot of it had to do with high oil prices and investment. So I became interested in the energy crisis, and I set out initially to write a fairly traditional diplomatic history of U.S. foreign policy and energy security from the perspective of research in the Johnson Library, the Nixon Library, the Ford Library, and the Carter Library. But as I was doing that research, and that's most of what I wrote my dissertation on, but as I was doing that research, these actors associated with OPEC and the United Nations kept coming up again and again as sort of the main interlocutors with the U.S. government, and I thought that they were really interesting and that they were making interesting arguments. So I really became fascinated by the time I was finishing up graduate school and starting to work with the ideas behind the energy crisis. And I started digging, and I found a lot of what I thought was interesting stuff, and the result is the book.
Hmm. Well, that's great. So it changed quite a bit from the dissertation to the thing that I read.
Yes. Yeah. It really did. I took a couple of big research trips after I finished the dissertation. One to the OPEC Information Center in Vienna, which had a lot of sort of interesting internal discussions within the organization and among its member states. And I took another trip to the United Nations Archive in Geneva, as well as to the one here in New York, but that's just down the road from me. So I found interesting connections there that sort of formed a scaffolding, and then I realized more and more, and a lot of this was through interlibrary loan. I realized more and more that there are deep connections between OPEC as sort of a commercial enterprise and the sort of broader third worldist explosion that comes with decolonization and the creation of a new sort of international society in the 1950s and in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let's get into the book. And so your book is filled with intellectuals and policymakers, you know, especially from the Global South. And just to help set the stage for the listeners, I was wondering if you could sketch for us who some of your actors are. You know, who were these oil elite? I mean, there's one person in particular that I think has a really interesting backstory, and that's Mahmoud Maghribi. So the U.S. educated, one-time in-house lawyer for Esso Libya, who then went on to become the director of oil policy under Gaddafi in Libya. So yeah, so who were these oil elite?
Right. I mean, you've really nailed it in describing Maghribi, and I think that he's representative of a broader group of actors that I describe as anti-colonial elites and the oil elites fall within that rubric. These are mostly lawyers, economists, some geologists, some professional policymakers and diplomats who were Western trained and end up representing either their home nations or OPEC in international discussions about oil. So other examples are Jamil Baroudi, who ends up being the permanent representative for Saudi Arabia at the United Nations. Abdul Rahman Pajwak is another example. He's the UN representative for Afghanistan. A really important one is Mohammed Salman, who becomes the director of the Arab League Petroleum Committee and then the oil minister for Iraq. Fuad Rouhani, who's the first secretary general of OPEC. Francisco Parra, who's a Venezuelan economist, who works for Arthur D. Little, and then moves from Arthur D. Little to OPEC in the 1960s. These are all actors that that play key roles at one point or another in making what becomes a very influential argument by the late 1960s about the effect of decolonization on the practice of sovereignty in the international political economy.
Hmm. I really want to get into their ideas because that's something that your book does a really, really good job of doing is just, you know, like tracing the intellectual lineages and political contexts of a lot of these ideas. And one way that you kind of connect everything is through what you call the economic culture of decolonization.
Right.
And so can you just tell our listeners what that very intriguing phrase means to you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I'm not sure if economic culture of decolonization is the right term. It's similar to ideology in some ways. What I meant by the economic culture of decolonization is that this group of anti-colonial elites they share a world of common reference and the identification of problems. In this case, the problem is sort of economic inequality as written into international law through oil concessions, and they look at a set of common solutions for that problem. In fact, they have to be common solutions because no one nation can really go it alone. They understand that, so they look for solutions through practices in the United Nations to support the right of sovereignty, what I describe as sovereign rights, as well as arguments about inequality that are based on terms of trade, and essentially, the Prebisch-Singer hypothesis, which is pushed forward in the United Nations in the 1950s, which argues that there's sort of a built-in structural inequality to the global economy, and in particular, based on low prices for natural resources. So that's what I mean by this culture that they share, is this shared set of views. They share a lot more, right? Their Western education, the fact that they're jet setters, that they're moving from meeting to meeting, that they're writing to each other, that they're producing a lot of work. So it's not culture in the sense that we normally think of sort of deep cultural history, but I would argue that they're a unified group that shares a set of experiences and a worldview that could be defined as culture.
Great. And what was the world that they encountered? That is like the world of oil extraction in like the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Like what was the political economy of oil?
Right. So this the world that they confronted has been very usefully described first by the oil historian Daniel Yergin, and then by others as the concessionary regime. There are a series of concessions signed mostly in the 1920s and 1930s that govern the oil production in the Middle East. Here we're looking at specifically Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and others, by which, from the perspective of the oil elites, the sovereigns of those nations signed over the national sovereignty, their control over resources to multinational companies. And those multinational companies controlled not only production, but also the income that those nations receive from their most important natural resource. So they're looking at that in the post-war era, in the post-World War II era, and they're looking for ways to amend for the most radical of them, overturn those contracts so they can get what they consider a fair deal for their oil.
Wonderful. And your book begins with an account of the Iran oil crisis of the 1950s. And so when Mossadegh sought to nationalize oil production in Iran, which then provoked Britain and the U.S. to respond by overthrowing his government. And so this was a really transformative moment, not just for the oil elites and intellectuals and policymakers of Iran, but for many of the actors in your book. And I was really blown away just by how often the memory of U.S. intervention was invoked. And it was invoked as an argument to not carry out anything that could be perceived as too radical. So can you share with listeners a little bit about this so-called crisis and why it casted such a long shadow on those oil elites?
Right. So I think Mossadegh is a fascinating figure because he really did sort of go to the international community with this argument about sovereignty in a grand way, right? He went to the international court. He went to the Security Council, and he made an argument that what Iran was looking for in nationalizing its oil and taking control or sovereignty over its oil was not that different from political decolonization. So he starts to make arguments about economic independence or economic sovereignty or economic decolonization that do reverberate over time. The Iranian nationalization also fails, right? As you note, and it's really interesting to see how the figure of Mossadegh sort of changes over time from being a warning against nationalization, right? This is what can happen to you if you commit nationalization, right? If you can think of nationalization as a sin, if you commit nationalization, and you're not ready for it, and then he sort of the vision of him shifts towards him being a martyr for an immovable cause, something that's bound to happen in history as decolonization becomes more deeply ingrained in international society, and sovereignty becomes more economic sovereignty becomes more possible for these actors. So you have Mossadegh sort of raised up as a warning in the earlier days, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, but by the late 1960s and early 1970s, his actions are depicted as sort of a harbinger of what's to come, right?
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And so moving onward, what were some of the oil elites' challenges in the rest of the 50s and 60s? And
right.
the challenges, the obstacles that prevented them from organizing themselves?
Right. So it's interesting because they really do organize themselves quite well, I think. It's interesting to think about OPEC as being part of a broader third world conglomerate, because it is the first third worldist grouping or grouping of the global South that does have a permanent secretariat with an official set of goals, right? And they organize really quickly to form a legal bureau, a public relations bureau, an economic bureau. They conduct all sorts of surveys often with the help of international consulting firms, oftentimes based on surveys conducted by the United Nations. And they really do conduct a fascinating information gathering effort, beginning with their founding in 1960. But they don't have immediate success. Not because they're not working together, but in part because of the economics of the international oil industry. In the 1950s and 1960s, although Western consumption is increasing at huge rates, and nations like Japan are increasing oil use, not to mention China, India, Brazil, et cetera. Although energy consumption is increasing, supply still outpaces demand in the global oil economy, and the United States itself has spare capacity to offset any supply disruptions, right? So if you look at the Iranian nationalization, the multinational companies, with the help of the U.S. Justice Department, are able to essentially blacklist Iranian oil from the international market, right? Which really does hurt Mossadegh's sort of forward-looking political stance and the legitimacy of his government within Iran itself. In the 1960s, nationalization or even sort of changes to the concessionary regime, wholesale changes to the concessionary regime, aren't seen to be possible because there always exists the possibility that one or two producers within OPEC can up their production at the expense of others. There's a great quote where the U.S. National Security Council is meeting, and Dwight Eisenhower says, "Well, we can just underbid any of the members, and we'll be fine." In that same meeting, Alan Dulles says, "Well, things might change. We can't discount them too much." This doesn't mean, though, that OPEC doesn't have sort of piecemeal successes over time. They do renegotiate royalties in between 1962 and 1965. And while they want more that they don't get, they do sort of establish themselves as a legitimate institution with which whom the multinational companies have to do business. So they have to negotiate. There are also a number, and I take pains to point this out in the book. There are also a number of new concessions signed, especially with Libya, as well as with Iran and Saudi Arabia, in the late 1950s and early 1960s, that are on much better terms than the concessions that were signed in the 1920s and 1930s. Those terms become sort of a guide that other producers can follow and improve upon over time, and are really important to understand exactly what OPEC and the oil producers are pushing for in 1970 and after.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question that I wanted to ask, which kind of relates to the last thing you were discussing about how negotiations between one country and a multinational becomes like a model for other countries to emulate. And so there's this like circulation of models and information that plays a really, really key role in your book, especially in the discussion of sovereign rights and in relation to oil. So, multinational corporations had a much better information coordination and management system, and this enabled them to set prices among other powers. Well, and at the same time, many of your oil elites were aware of this and tried to create initiatives to challenge the sort of like the information dominance of the multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. And so can you elaborate on this just the important role of information in your story?
Yes, absolutely. I start the story right after the Iran and Suez crises. And it was really interesting for me to see that the Arab League sent its president to the famous Bandung meeting, and that his records of that meeting emphasize the meeting of the Economic Bureau of the conference, at which they did discuss oil and low prices for natural resources in language that is a direct echo of Latin American arguments about unequal terms of trade and the need to overturn those unequal terms of trade. After that, and I found this out using mostly British documents, but some stuff that's just available in the public record. The Arab League does plan what becomes the first Arab Petroleum Congress, which meets in 1959, and there they do start to exchange information. Really important actors here include the Libyan oil minister, a guy named Anas Qasim, who had rewritten Libyan oil law in 1954 and 1955 to reflect sort of the changes that he thought were necessary to the concessionary regime. So smaller concessions with a specific ending date to encourage the concessionaires, the companies working there, to work more quickly and produce more oil at the risk of losing their concessions. So already in the late 1950s, through the Arab Petroleum Congress, which is through the Arab League, this exchange of information is beginning. After the multinationals decide to lower posted prices to maintain their profits, and essentially lower the amount that they're paying to the host governments, a group of leaders who had met at the first Arab Petroleum Congress come together again in Baghdad, where the Iraqi government invites them, and form OPEC. And the first thing they do is start to gather information. Mm-hmm. And this is where they hire the Arthur D. Little firm to produce a report on the oil concessions. This is a report that's written by Francisco Parra, who's a Venezuelan economist who later is hired to work directly for OPEC and becomes sort of one of the main public voices for these arguments about sovereign rights, and later becomes OPEC's Secretary General in 1968. But if you go to the OPEC Information Center, you can see that by the time Parra is there, there's just this huge effort to try to get every single national oil law on the books and printed, so that others can read it. And here, I think they modeled themselves after the United Nations Permanent Sovereignty Committee, which did the same thing, but with all national laws and constitutions that tried to guarantee some form of economic sovereignty. So there are these huge sort of doomsday book information gathering efforts that are crucial not only to understanding the world that these elites inhabited, but to understand the problems that they faced and potential solutions for those.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Can you elaborate a little bit about the position of OPEC and oil producing nations within the broader third worldist movement?
Well, it's interesting. OPEC always tries to depict itself as being representative of a broader set of interests that has to do with economic sovereignty or sovereign rights, as they would have it. At times, they are quite representative in the arguments that they're making about international law, about inequality in the global economy. But oil is oftentimes left out when you have meetings of the UN Conference of Trade and development, for example. And the oil producers, especially the ones with relatively small populations that have a lot of oil, aren't really representative of a broader set of third world problems. So there is a schism here about the question of how representative oil actually is, whether or not there is an oil exceptionalism, for lack of a better term. And you see that division between what Henry Kissinger describes in 1974 as the haves and the have-nots. You see that division becoming much clearer as oil prices go up, right? And this helps out, obviously it helps out the oil producers quite a bit, but it also creates the problem of debt and sovereign debt for many third world nations. So that that schism between sovereignty and sovereign rights on the one hand and sovereign debt on another one, I think points to a I guess a tension in this question of how representative OPEC actually is.
Great. I think, yeah, we're definitely going to talk more about that because that's a very key moment in your book.
Right.
So we're finally leading up to the oil revolution, and things start to sort of change like after the year 1970, mm-hmm. Just in terms of the solidarity that is shared among oil producing nations, despite their various political differences. You even call the period from I think it's 71 to 73 as the heyday of oil power. And can you just say something a little bit about those changes that led to the growing sense of solidarity?
Yeah, I can. It's an interesting set of events that leads to this moment. I think a key moment here that happens before that that oftentimes we don't connect to the energy crisis is the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. I think that this changed a lot of the oil elite's perspectives on how much they could do and how quickly. I think it also plays a key role in a couple of sort of geopolitical stories that come together in 1970 and 1971 that really embolden the oil producers, whether they're Arab or not, whether they're concerned about the Arab-Israeli conflict and at what level. So one of these is that in as a result of the Six-Day War and Iraqi pressure, as far as I can tell, conservative monarchies like Saudi Arabia and Libya in particular begin to move their investments out of the pound sterling, which exacerbates an economic crisis in Great Britain, and ultimately leads the British government to decide to pull out their forces east of Suez. In particular, of interest for me is in the Persian Gulf. This creates a vacuum. This is described by U.S. policymakers all the time as the British vacuum, which the Shah of Iran didn't really like because he said, "Well, there's not that much of a vacuum. I can fill it." This in turn leads the United States, as we know, to look at the Shah as a guardian of the Persian Gulf. This is part of the Nixon doctrine and the twin pillars policy, and all of that. And so the United States looks at Iran as well as Saudi Arabia as sort of new regional powers and military powers. That will be responsible for maintaining stability in this crucial area. Iran is really good at using this and their need for military hardware to make arguments, especially to the Nixon administration, that the multinational oil companies need to yield a little bit in their intransigent attitude towards creating more income. For Iran, and this sort of dovetails with a couple of other important events that lead up to this, I guess what I call the heyday of oil power. Another important, I guess, aftershock of the Six-Day War is a regime change in Libya. There are already major problems with stability in this sort of westward-looking Cold War ally for the United States, which is an ally under the monarchy of King Idris. The Libyan Revolution occurs in 1969, and all of a sudden you have sort of a radical regime coming into power that plans to use oil sovereignty to its advantage. You'll remember from earlier in the discussion that Libyan oil law was different from the concessionary regime, and this puts Libya in a relatively strong place within the international political economy of oil to make demands of its producers, many of which are smaller producers, and one of which, Occidental Oil, relies on Libyan oil for a lot of its a lot of its production and distribution. So that's another important aspect of this of this sort of early 70s story. The third one is that the international economy of oil shifts from a buyer's market to a seller's market. In other words, supply dips below demand, and all of a sudden, the OPEC producers, as a group, have economic leverage that they didn't have before. So when Libya does begin to slow down production to pressure Occidental and then the major oil companies in 1970. They're doing it in a relatively dry market. Not only do they have the support of OPEC, they're also doing it in a dry market. So all of a sudden, practices that were seen as being sort of sketchy in the 1960s have the possibility of success. It's still a risk, but it seems to many people that they're more likely to be successful in this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to bring it back to the level of your oil elites, someone like Mahmoud Maghribi is a really representative case because, you know, he went from being opposed to these, like, you know, so-called radical actions against the international oil regime to, you know, being at the forefront of a lot of the demands from OPEC. So.
That's right. When he was doing his law degree, his LLM at George Washington, he wrote a really interesting thesis where he said, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to be possible in current conditions for any one nation to press for nationalization. That was in 1966. 4 years later, he is the main oil negotiator for the Libyan Revolutionary Command Council, and he's negotiating just that. So he always believed and hoped that this would be a possibility, but when he took sort of a cold, rational look at it in the in the mid 1960s, he didn't think it was possible. Of course, as you know, in 1967, he's working as an in-house lawyer for Esso Libya and gets fired because he helps organize strikes of students and of dock workers from the inside. Then he goes to Beirut. We assume that while he's there, he interacts with Abdullah al-Tariki, the so-called Red Sheikh from Saudi Arabia, and I think sort of begins to see that these possibilities, which Tariki had argued for throughout the 1950s and 1960s, are that much more likely, sort of given the geopolitical and economic situation, the changing context of the changing circumstances, to use the phrase that that OPEC lawyers like to use, of the late 1960s and early 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Great, and so we're finally approaching the you know, the oil revolution itself, and I was hoping that you could just kind of sketch out the broad currents of what the you know, like this, the OPEC crisis or oil revolution was, and more importantly, how your history or the story that you're telling is different from other tellings? Like how does the, putting the oil crisis in conversation with the past two decades of oil elites organizing change the narrative?
Right. So I think that there's still a fairly strong narrative that OPEC and its members didn't really have an intellectual history or an ideology. They're just interested in the bottom line, and they certainly are interested in increasing their control over production, increasing the price of oil, and increasing the rents from oil that their nations receive. But there is a longer history behind that, and to make an argument about sovereign rights helps us understand, I think, more clearly the contours of what's going on between 1970 and 1973. The fact that the gradualists, as I call them, Iran and Saudi Arabia in particular, can work closely with the insurrectionists like Libya and Iraq and Algeria. I think the fact that they make arguments that that their economic sovereignty is something that Western nations, governments, and the oil companies have to accept as a given in international society is something that we oftentimes forget. This is a generation that grew up in decolonization and understood colonialism and informal imperialism, economic imperialism, as something very real and something that could occur again in their lifetimes. It wasn't just dead letter. So I think that perspective helps us understand something about why the energy crisis was so revolutionary, why it was so important, so shocking for so many people, both in the global South and in the global North. I think in terms of policy, I don't want to go too far into the weeds, but it helps us understand why Libya's nationalization of BP, for example, which is a response to the Iranian occupation of islands once controlled by the British when the British leave, why that is widely accepted and supported by other members of OPEC that don't support Libya in all of its more radical policies. It helps us explain, too, why when Iraq nationalizes in April of 1972, why there's a certain amount of OPEC solidarity behind Iraq to the point that the companies aren't able to blacklist or to blacken Iraqi oil the way they could Iranian oil a couple of decades earlier. So there are all sorts of little ways in which the story of international law and sovereignty and arguments about inequality in the international economy inform these events and help us understand exactly why they happened the way they did. The best example is probably the link between the oil revolution and the founding of the new international economic order through the United Nations. I don't think that those two stories can be told completely if they're told apart from each other. I think it's really important to connect those two stories, even if it doesn't turn out the way say the Algerians who call for the sixth special session of the United Nations in 1974 the way that they hoped.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, this segues perfectly into my the next question that I really wanted to ask, which was just about that relationship between the new international economic order and the energy crisis in OPEC. And so you've already kind of alluded to how sort of like the energy crisis and OPEC's success becomes really inspirational for advocates of the new international economic order. But then it doesn't last. to tell this story together shows that OPEC's successes really undermined the new international economic order's ambitions. So can you discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, I do feel like the new international economic order flares out fairly quickly, although there's a lot of new scholarship on this on these questions coming out now. Every time I go to the annual conference of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations, it seems like there's a couple of fascinating panels on these very questions. So I don't think the jury is in on anything that I've argued, but it does seem to me that the new international economic order does sort of fail in its deeper challenge to structures of inequality, and this argument about sovereign rights, which is seen within those international lawyers who believe in it, and international economists is sort of a good counterpart to human rights. In fact, sort of a deeper challenge to structural inequality in the international economy than human rights could be. There is this sense of possibility. You see this especially in the United Nations and the UN Conference on Trade and Development, where Manuel Perez Guerrero, who's deeply involved in this whole story, he was present at the first Arab Petroleum Congress. He's working closely with sort of the internationalization of Venezuelan oil policy in the 1960s, and then becomes the director of UNCTAD.
What's that acronym? Can you spell it out for listeners?
The UN Conference of Trade and Development. He becomes the Secretary General there, and he does hope that the broader grouping of the G77, the group of 77 in the United Nations can sort of ride the wind of the oil revolution to make arguments about structural adjustments, not neoliberal structural adjustments, but anti-colonial structural adjustments to the international economy through a series of meetings. And ultimately, even he himself admits, and one of my interesting finds was a letter that he wrote right around the beginning of the new international economic order, where he says this would be great, but I don't know if it will be possible. And you have to imagine him; he's receiving a flood of reports across his desk, many of which celebrate the achievements of OPEC as achievements for the broader third world, but also more and more, many of which note sort of the crippling debt, the crippling oil-related debt, to use the phrase that was common then, that many developing nations faced at that time. And I saw this again and again in the embassy reports that were coming back to the United States, as the United States was sort of looking for a way to undermine the new international economic order, just sort of how large and I guess unprecedented this type of debt actually was, even in 1974, but certainly by 1975, 1976, 1977.
Absolutely. Moving forward into the present, what are some of the legacies of the oil revolution for world politics and the world economy?
Well, I think there's still a lot of work on this to be done, and this is one of the exciting things about working on the 1970s and thinking about the 1980s is that the archival record is really starting to open up for diplomatic historians and international historians. I think that one of the most interesting questions that we can ask about this period is about the energy crisis, is how the energy crisis sort of shaped modern globalization. In some ways, globalization, at least when I look at some of the U.S. documents from this period, is depicted as a battle against sovereign rights. It's sort of the United States, I think, fairly consistently identifies nationalism, especially resource nationalism, as not only illegitimate, but as sort of an existential threat to global economic health. And I think once you start to think about that as an ideology, it becomes fairly easy to decipher specific policy policy pathways that are meant to undermine nationalism as a threat not only to global economic health, but sort of the columns of that global economic health, the most important one of which is a respect for private property. So I do think that there are really interesting outcomes to this that it doesn't seem to me that many of the oil elites had really thought of. There are a number of other ones that are quite interesting, but I think that that's the most important one.
Great. Well, I think that's a perfect way to wrap up the discussion about the book. So, what are you working on right now?
That's a great question. I've got a couple of projects that I'm working on. The main one is a history of American nationalism and global oil from World War I to the War on Terror. That's with Bloomsbury Academic, and I'm really looking forward to sort of trying to tell a full 20th century story that looks at it from the perspective of the United States and takes into consideration economic policy, military policy, alongside foreign policy, but also that looks at domestic culture and consumption as sort of an important driver of questions about energy insecurity and vulnerability in the United States. So that's one project. In the longer range, I'm thinking about a history that looks at decolonization and violence, but from the perspective of Ralph Bunche and United Nations peacekeeping, and I've started to do some research for that in the Bunche papers, and that's really I'm really excited about that one too. But those are the two major projects.
Great. Well, those sound fantastic, and I can't wait to read them. Though I will be patient, I promise.
Yes, you'll have to exercise great patience, I believe.
Great. Well, I really want to thank you again for speaking with me today, Chris.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much, Dexter. It's really been wonderful, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Of course. And you've been listening to New Books in Intellectual History, a channel of the New Books Network. And we've been talking today with Christopher Dietrich about his book, Oil Revolution.